As indicated, the topic for this afternoon has to do with Christ, the Prince of Peace. And the verses, of course, that you would call to mind with reference to this is over in Isaiah, there in the 9th chapter, in particular verse 6, but also as the completion of the context, verse 7 as well. Although you won't find, I don't believe, the same language elsewhere, nevertheless, certainly the thought is contained in many different places. Just very briefly, let's take note with regard to the wording of this passage. You've heard it many times before. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And of course, as is reflected in so many of the lessons, not only here but in other lectureships, many, many passages that reflect with regard to the greatness of Christ. And I sometimes think with regard to this, that the greatness is so beyond our language, not just the English language, but any language, and even our comprehension, that it's almost as though there was a straining of effort to find the words that man could fathom that would explain the greatness of Christ. And the language here, of course, is but part of that. We, of course, are looking particularly with respect to that short phrase, the Prince of Peace. Might think with regard to some aspects of this, and just to remind you with regard to some of the words, and I don't know, I think it was Tommy that had made mention of it within his lesson with respect to how that some, of course, do not consider him to be the Christ, the Messiah, although they may indeed agree that he was a good man or possibly even a great man, but not the Messiah. A lot might depend on just exactly who you talk to and where. We do know, of course, that the Jews at the time of Christ, for the most part, definitely did not accept him because, naturally, they had something else firmly in mind. And no doubt, as they would read the Scriptures, and as you might very well have gathered even from this, and had we lived in that day and time, we may have thought the same thing, unless we were paying attention to just exactly what Jesus was saying and what he was doing, and we very readily recognize that he was fulfilling the prophecies about the one who was to come. But if we weren't doing that, we would very likely think just as many of them did, and that is that the Messiah is going to establish an earthly kingdom. And especially when you're under the thumb of the Roman Empire, and that doesn't set very well with you, and I don't think the Romans thought any more of them than they did of the Romans, but be that as it may, you're going to be looking for something else and hoping and dreaming and praying for something else. And you want to restore the power and the prestige and the wealth that existed during David and Solomon, and not only for that area, but to have the prestige throughout the world that would seem to come with such a king. Well, of course, Christ did come, and he fulfilled everything that had been spoken of. When we think with regard to some of these terms, and they're no different than you might otherwise have thought, so don't expect to add anything basically new with regard to it, but the idea of one who is a prince is generally thought of as that which is hereditary, and it carries beyond, and even as within the passage as used here, it's rather broad in a sense, but certainly Jesus fulfills all of this definition. One who has authority, one who bears rule, a royalty or a royal official, a leader in war, a ruler of prosperity, one who gives all blessings. Certainly he fulfills all of that and more. He is to be not just a prince, but a prince of peace. No question with respect to that. And here again, we might conjure up several thoughts with regard to what might constitute peace. It carries the idea of a lack of conflict, of tranquility. You're not in any difficulty with anyone, but if you stop and think with respect to it, you can appreciate that there is both an outward peace and an inward peace. You can have very readily outward peace as a result of individuals you're in a conflict with. Maybe your neighbors are giving you all kinds of trouble. They have difficulty at work. And there are people who are threatening to take your property or breaking in and stealing from you. Or it may be on a broader scale, as some neighborhoods think that they're in a war zone simply because of all the problems that are going on within that community. Or as a nation where you are literally involved in a warfare. That's certainly an outer conflict. And yet an individual can have an outer conflict and be at peace inwardly. Not be troubled by so many things that might plague others. And you sometimes wonder at some individuals who just seem to be able to take everything in stride. Not that they're ignoring it or anything, but they don't let it eat them up. And I couldn't help but think with regard to an individual, it probably wasn't true, that in any event I'd read about some time ago, that was known for being a very peaceful individual, lived out in a farm area, hunted, had rifles, that sort of thing. One night he heard noise and went to check, and sure enough there was a prowler there in his house. Of course, he had taken his gun with him. And as he aimed the gun, he said, "Stranger, I wouldn't hurt you for the world, but I'm about to shoot where you're standing." Well, you know, there's a time for peace, and sometimes there's a time for war. We can have the war again, and we can have inner peace, or sometimes individuals have a tremendous amount of inner conflict that is going on. And in spite of all of this, everything around them would seem to be at peace. But they are forever plagued, even sometimes by, to others, what might seem to be imaginary. But nevertheless, they are never at peace with themselves. So there is an outward peace and there is an inward peace. And I would put in with this, you can count it as a part of peace or otherwise, but unity. The idea of oneness, that of, it's oftentimes portrayed as being fellowship. It is that in which people are working together in harmony. You can be in a work situation or a family situation, and you may all be together, but there may not be any unity. There may be a complete lack of harmony. You may ultimately get the project done or move things forward, but it's only with the greatest of difficulty. Even little children can appreciate it. You probably listen to them at times, and you no doubt, as I, when you were growing up and you got together with a number of others to play and you came up with a game, you may have contrived it yourself or not knowing the rules of the game properly. Anyway, you simply got together and you made up your own rules. And some of them you had to make up as you went along as you encountered situations. But nevertheless, in order for things to be accomplished, there had to be unity. That's one of the great things that we know is stressed throughout the Scriptures. Jesus prayed in the 17th chapter of John that all might be one, even as He and the Father are one. Fourth chapter of book of Ephesians, there in the first few verses, that spells out a number of things in which there is just one, and the idea of unity over and over and over again is stressed. So that becomes, I think, a part of the total picture. But even as we think with regard to Jesus and His being the Prince of Peace, there is likewise called to mind a statement which was made by Jesus Himself over in the 10th chapter of the book of Matthew, there in verses 34 and 35. Again, that's 10th chapter of Matthew, verses 34 and 35. No question as to what Jesus is saying. "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law." Now, you might see some of that when you're talking about the in-laws, but the rest of that might sound a bit you know, contrary to being the Prince of Peace. It might even sound a bit contrary to that which Paul had spoken of over in 1 Corinthians. You remember the statement that he makes in the 14th chapter in verse 33? Very simple statement. For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace in all the churches of the saints. I think you understand and would appreciate in any way, and that certainly there is no conflict whatsoever. Let me ask you for a moment. Would you care to be in a nation where the ruler of the nation, where whether you have a president or a king or whatever the form of government that you might have, did not care enough about the people or the nation that they ruled over and represented to fight for it, to protect it, to look out for its enemies, and to keep them out of its borders, to enable the people to live safely? Would you want that kind of an individual? Say, oh, we have a ruler who is a ruler of peace, and he's going to have peace at any cost. He's going to be very peaceful. He's not going to fight for anything. Well, if you had a choice in having that individual, would you want him? I doubt very seriously if you would. Let's look at a couple of things at the moment. Might seem to digress, but really looking with regard to, is there really a conflict there? Go back to the book of Judges, as a matter of fact. The very last verse of the very last chapter, that ought to take you to the 21st chapter and the 25th verse. And the statement is made at least one other time before that. You probably again remember. And very likely a very fitting verse for it to close with. And in essence, it indicates that at that time there was no king in the land. And every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Would you want to have lived in that type of an environment? Well, at first thought, maybe you would, because you could do whatever you wanted to. Wouldn't make any difference what anybody thought or what anybody said. If you had the ability to do it, you could just go do it. But on second thought, it would also mean everybody else could do the same thing. If somebody was walking down the street and happened to see your automobile and they liked it, they just take it. Nobody say anything or do anything unless you're big enough and strong enough to get it back from them. And about the only way you're going to protect yourself from others is to begin to band together in communities and maybe put walls and things of that nature, but otherwise you're completely at the mercy of just anybody or any group of people that come along that happen to be a bit stronger than you. No protection whatsoever. I wouldn't want to live in that kind of an environment. Do you recall some of the passages that we have within the New Testament? For example, go over to 1 Timothy. There to the second chapter, first few verses. Again, that's 1 Timothy, second chapter, and the first few verses. Paul tells Timothy, he said, I exhort therefore that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all that are in authority, that we may do what? That we may live a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty, for this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior. What are kings supposed to be doing? What are you praying for them doing? They'll conduct themselves in such a manner as a ruler that we may live a quiet and peaceable life. How are they going to do that? We're going to just think peace and it's going to happen? Do you think you can disband your armed forces? Do you think you can disband your police and that peace is going to reign because there's not going to be anybody that's going to pose a threat? Well, some have almost advocated going that far, but that doesn't bring peace, nor is it what God contemplated. If you will go back over into the 13th chapter of the book of Romans, which for the most part is directed with respect to those who are in positions of authority, and it starts out by indicating that let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Not that any particular form of government, but God ordained that we should have governments. Not only that, whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Now that's a part of the responsibility of government. Cuts a line, doesn't it? If you are doing good, if you are a law-abiding citizen, you have no reason to fear the one who is in power. And, of course, he has a responsibility. He's going to have to answer to God. So if he's carrying that out properly, he's doing what God expects of him. And as a good citizen, you are expected to behave and to obey the law. So you're not going to be a troublemaker. You have nothing whatsoever to fear. You walk down the streets, you do your business, you have your job, you raise your family, and you have peace and you have security, and all is well because you're behaving. But that's not going to be true with regard to the lawbreaker, to the evildoer, because if that ruler is doing his job, God says he's not bearing that sword in vain. God intends that that individual be made to answer for those things that he has done that is wrong. Now, surely, when God expects this of those who rule over earthly kingdoms, when we think with regard to Jesus as being a Prince of Peace, indeed he is. To those who follow after him, there is no doubt whatsoever that he provides them the greatest of assurity and the greatest of peace. Certainly inner peace, and peace of that which will go far beyond anything we can imagine, will certainly be in the hereafter. But he provides that peace. But the individual that opposes him, he is frequently portrayed as one who comes warring to destroy those who oppose him. You might notice with respect to some of the statements likewise that you otherwise find, you might remember from the time that Jesus stood before Pilate, that should be over in about the 18th chapter of the book of John, about verse 36, and there in the discussion that took place, Jesus made a statement to the effect that my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, then my servants would fight. Now, I think there's some implications just in that brief statement alone. One is that he indeed had a kingdom. Different type of kingdom, obviously. And I think there is the assumption there that the kingdom that he had and the nature of it, that it would fight. And there was a war that was going on. Not a physical one, but indeed they were to fight. Look, for example, likewise over into 2 Corinthians and there in the 10th chapter. And there should not be any doubt with respect to the nature of the fact that we are in a war. And I'm sure you who are here are convinced of that already. Again, the 10th chapter of 2 Corinthians. I'm going to just pick up with verse 3 and a couple of verses there. For though we walk in the flesh, now we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringeth into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, and having in readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Our warfare is not of this world, not of the flesh. But believe me, we are in a war. Our weapons are not worldly weapons, but the weapons that do we have are spiritual in nature, and it's for the pulling down and the destruction of those things that oppose God. Matter of fact, if we went back into 1 Timothy, into the first chapter, verses just preceding the part that I read to just a few minutes ago about praying for the kings, those in authority. Again, 1 Timothy, 1st chapter, and verse 18 and following. He said to Timothy, "This charge I commit unto thee, son Timothy, according to the prophecies which went before on thee, that you do what? That thou by them mightst war a good warfare, holding faith and a good conscience, which some having put away concerning faith have made shipwreck." And what did Paul say in the closing portion of his second letter to Timothy when his life was drawing to a close? "I have fought a good fight, and I have kept the faith." He wasn't standing by. How are you going to obtain peace, by the way? You want peace? How are you going to get it? Well, in relationship with individual to individual, or even with nation to nation or business to business, there are probably any number of ways that it might be achieved and ultimately be successful. But when you're talking about a warfare that is between God and Satan, and we as individuals on this earth are either on one side or the other, and there is no neutrality, and there isn't any possibility of saying, "I'm on your side, but I'm going to set it out," how are you going to win it? Can you compromise or negotiate? What are you going to compromise on? It would mean you'll have to give up something in the way of righteousness. What else do you have to give up? What are you going to negotiate on? Is there anything to negotiate with? There's nothing to negotiate over. If so, pray tell, what is it? So you can't negotiate, you can't compromise on anything. What about just surrender? Well, you could do that, and many people obviously have. But that's not going to do it either. We know even with those who are lukewarm, like those of Laodicea, that it was quite clear that because they were lukewarm, he said, "I'd rather you'd be cold or hot, but because you're lukewarm, I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. You're no good to me." And don't you recognize that if you have a lot of people that you're depending on, I don't care whether it's an army or a congregation or a workplace or whatever, if you've got a number of people who are busy working, but on the other hand, you also have a large number that are doing nothing or just occupying space, they can easily be a hindrance more than a help. And nowhere do we find any acceptability. On the other hand, you find many passages, such as Hebrews 11 and 6, which indicate that without faith it's impossible to please Him, for he that cometh to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. That would very readily suggest that if you don't diligently seek Him, don't look for any reward. There's not any to come. And of course, many of these, of course, are quite familiar passages, such as 1 John, there in the second chapter, where he talks about those things that are pertain to the flesh and of the world. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. The world passes away, the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. My lights have come on and are beginning to go off. There's a lot more I was going to say. But in any event, we're still looking for peace. At least want to touch on Philippians 4, remind you of a passage there. Jesus, of course, our Prince of Peace. And if we want peace, we're going to have to rally behind him. He is the only source of peace. And if all men of this earth would follow the Lord as he has dictated and within the capability of man, we would have peace on this earth. Outward peace. Likewise in your communities or within your family. And likewise, by following the Lord, you will have inner peace. And note what he had to say with respect to this in Philippians 4. Starting with verse 6. Be careful for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do. And what's the result of it? And the God of peace shall be with you. Now, you may not find this old world, and none of us will, completely to our liking, and good reason, because we look for a better world and a better place. But Jesus is our Prince of Peace, and he offers peace to all men. But regrettably, most do not turn to them. And therefore, he is in opposition to them. Let us be sure that we follow him as our King and our ruler, our Prince of Peace. Thank you very much.